Now I ask Pierre de Bellenor of the Université Sorbonne de Paris that he will give a speech about the title was Methodological Individualism and Collective Representation. Please, Pierre. And I think we may also avoid to do the coffee break now.
Hello to everyone. I want to thank Nathalie for her kind invitation in this amphitheater I am familiar with because it is my university. We have much more modern rooms, but this one is rather solemn. It's not the most solemn one. But I like coming here because this is a place where I met Merton. I shook hands with Merton here in this very room. He was invited at a conference in honor of Paul Lazarsfeld. And I was a young student. I was doing my PhD with Raymond Boudon. And so I attended this conference and I just shook hands with Merton. So this is something, it's like shaking hands with Durkheim, who was professor, as Nathalie mentioned, in this university as well. Nathalie was not very wise in selecting the dates of this conference because, you know, there is an annual meeting of sociologists in France, and it is today and tomorrow in Lyon, another city. So I guess most of French sociologists are in Lyon today, but I'm not sure they would have attended, but since things are uncertain, maybe they would have attended. I'm happy to be here as well because there are important thinkers that have had an influence on me, on my formation, like Karl Dieter Hope, Ricardo Viale, who is one of the first ones who has introduced me to cognitive psychology, and Erhard Friedberg. I have read him a long time ago. And then I grew up with friends who are here. We were PhD students at the same time, Emmanuel, Renaud, Nathalie, and so on. So it's an interesting another new generation. But our PhD students are not here today. They are in Lyon. So I have a big topic. I will do it very quickly because I have no time to go in depth. I will just mention a certain amount of themes. And as I said, I want to be quick. So there is an influential French philosopher who has a big influence in France among sociologists and in philosophers. His name is Vincent Descombes, who is maybe the most outspoken defender of holism in this country, and I guess he has some kind of influence abroad as well. And the main idea he developed is that the group precedes the individual, and he referred this idea to the so-called, in his mind, French sociology, that is Durkheim and Mauss and Louis Dumont, who are supposed to have proposed the idea that we cannot understand an individual without understanding the group he or she belongs to. And this makes sense to a certain extent. If we consider all the migrations issues we have now, people belong to groups, and people are defined by the group they belong to. And to a large extent, they react according to the group they belong to or they are supposed to belong to, and so on. And I don't know how we can understand something like the conflict that exists between Israelis and Palestinians without taking into account the idea of the importance of group. So my point here is to try to understand how we can make this claim false and consider that, in fact, there is a theory of based on methodological individualism that explain why people belong to groups, have a strong sense of identity, and will act according to their group belonging. So this is a big project. I have written a lot about that. I will just give some quick ideas because Nathalie had asked me to write something about methodological individualism. So there are three basic ideas for methodological individualism I will return here. The first one, those three ideas seems to me rather consensual. And they are very old. In fact, they are not new ideas by any way. The first basic idea is that social life depends on the action of individual actors. This is something that goes against the idea that there are laws at a system level, independent of individual actors. I think that this point has been made clearly for the first time by John Stuart Mill, but maybe it has been made before, in a critique of Auguste Comte's theory of laws situated at the level systems, at the level of the systems. Of course, actors act within the framework of given social situation. This is something that is clearly mentioned by John Stuart Mill himself as well. In my paper, I have all the quotations. And although he does not use the word structure, clearly the idea is that people act within structure environment that include institution norms and collective representations that are prevalent at a given time. This social structure idea is developed by many authors, like Peter Blow, of course, James Coleman, in The Foundations of Social Theory. He distinguished three levels of the structure: the relative positions of the elements within a system, the level of the aggregate data, and all the social norms and institutions that tend to prevail in a given situation. And of course, all those elements have an effect, influence on the behavior of people. For instance, people will dissent more or less depending on the number of people who already dissent, and so on, in those classical analyses made by James Coleman. The second idea, which has been clearly stated by Max Weber, and in the paper I quote the passage where he says that clearly, is that we do not have a simple macro causality that does not rely on individual actors and behavior. And all this has led to the generative mechanism literature that is present in Weber's conceptualization and which has been developed by many authors. For instance, Raymond Boudon or Mohamed Cherkaoui, who was a member of our research team, and more recently in the so-called analytical sociology movement, which has introduced new tools for developing this generative mechanism strategy, but the idea is more ancient. Something I want to emphasize here is that this mechanism, classical approach, can introduce collective beliefs at the level of the macro, of the beginning of the process, but at the level of the macro behavior as well. It is the case in the so famous example of the development of capitalism made by Weber, the way it is conceptualized by Coleman in the so-called Coleman's Bolt, where you have at the first macro level Protestantism, and then at the individual level, and adherence to Protestant values that lead to asceticism. So at the macro level and at the micro level, you have cultural norms, in fact. And those two cultural norms lead to a new norm, which is capitalism. So, in fact, at the macro level and at the micro level, we have collective structures or collective representations. So the mechanism model that is linked to MI can include collective representation even at the level of individual actors. This is a very important point, which means that when you are at the individual level, you are not necessarily at an individual in the sense that where people would not adhere to collective beliefs or social norms. I will come back to that. A third point, which is now rather controversial if you read the conclusion that Peter Hedstrom has made to the Handbook to Analytical Sociology edited by Gianluca Manzo. He said that as opposed to what he emphasized earlier in his career, he does not think anymore that a mechanism should rely on intelligible, purposive actions, and that the only requirement is behaviors that can be relatively unknown, just because, in fact, we don't know what are the mental states that occur within individuals. And so he's more interested in the structure of the mechanism than in finding the intelligible motives of individual actors. Strangely enough, that was an argument made by Durkheim, that we don't know what occurs in people's minds. And I think that it's difficult to avoid having a mechanism without having purposive actions. I'll come back to that again. So the idea is that in order to make a connection between the initial macro level, the initial micro level, and the outcome at the macro level, you need to rely on something that is intelligible, more or less, because this is what allows you to make the link. Otherwise, you have no link. But what does it mean, an intelligible action? This is a difficult question. This is a difficult question. And we often refer to the idea of understanding, of purposive action, and so on. But those concepts are not necessarily very clear. My impression is that in the given literature, social science literature, when we purport to understand what an action is and to find it intelligible, and there are some actions that we do not find intelligible at all, like maybe cannibalism in situations where people are not in, where there is no social norms that favor cannibalism, or there is no real need for food, but just you do that for pleasure, we have a hard time understanding why people do that and whether it is intelligible or not. So mostly when we consider that an action is intelligible, we consider that it corresponds to ordinary psychological tendencies, including maybe what might be called irrational attitudes, but that are understandable, and Weber says that, in fact. All the domain of action that is related to the issue of rationality, and I will come back to this issue of rationality in a moment, and collective social norm. We tend to understand that people identify themselves with being Israeli or Palestinian, because there are such norms that tell you, you are Palestinian or you are Israeli. And when people tell you, I am a Palestinian or I am Israeli, we understand that they belong to a group defined by a set of social norms, and we accept that as something that is understandable. whether it is rational or not to be so, or whether it is based on psychological tendencies or not. It's just a social norm. So the basic idea is that while collective representations do indeed exist, as well as social structure, and this is at the core of Coleman's work, for instance, they inevitably rely on some things that might be labeled in a narrower sense as individual, that are responsible for those collective representations. So I think that an important dimension of methodological individualism is to try to figure out how something that can be named individual in a narrow sense can be responsible for something that is collective, shared, linked to social norms that are themselves part of the general device of explanation and understanding that are present in methodological individuals. And therefore, it's interesting to try to figure out what can be responsible for the sense of belonging to a group, whether it is something that really corresponds to the way Descombes described that, with a group that receives the individual, or whether we can find something that would be individual that explains the sense of group belonging beyond any kind of rational dimension. So, as I just said, individual actions can be based on collective representations. There is thus no fundamental opposition between the idea that individual actors are responsible for social life, because they alone act within the limits of given social structure, and the idea that they are shared collective representation. I think there is nothing really in the idea that actors are responsible for social life in preventing us from accepting the idea that they share a sense of collective representations and shared social norms. From this perspective, there is essentially no difference between so-called holism and methodological individualism, because people can adhere to collective representation, in particular belonging to a group. And as Durkheim clearly said, and I have the quotation in my paper, there is no reason to make an ontology of the group level or social level. It is only shared representations, and those shared representations are the ones that Max Weber insists on as well. So from this point of view, there is, I think, a very simple continuity. So the issue then is to try to explain the emergence of such collective representations, the formations of shared beliefs, and the formations, for instance, of groups on the basis of so-called individual elements. So what is the individual elements we can suspect are responsible for those collective behavior? What are those individual motives, if they are to be found? There are two typical candidates in the literature, and following Raymond Boudon, but I had written something about economic rationality before Raymond Boudon developed his critique in my PhD thesis on Homo economicus. There are two reductionisms that should be avoided, one that is the economic reductionism and one that would be the psychological reductionism. Economic reductionism, the very simple idea here is that the principle of methodological individualism, the one I have summarized before, do not imply at all that people will act necessarily on the basis of an economic behavior if this concept has a clear meaning. I agree with what Erhard Friedberg has said this morning. I think that the notion of interest, the notion of cost and benefit as well, are imprecise notions. And in fact, here we have two possible positions. One is to reject the idea of economic analysis on the basis that the notion of economic motives is too imprecise. And that was something that has been highlighted by Pareto, the first one, who purported to replace the notion of utility by the notion of felimity, precisely on the basis that people have different preferences. Some like to smoke, some others do not like to smoke. So where is the utility here? And when you try to understand this in terms of costs and benefits, here again we find the same difficulty. That is, what is a cost and what is a benefit? In his book, Karl Dieter, the last book, mentioned the importance of going beyond the so-called cost-benefit analysis and to introduce the idea that people have beliefs and so on, and a strategy towards realizing their beliefs. But at the same time, often he introduced the idea of cost, like this is costly, this is not costly. In fact, in the legacy of Pareto, the very difficult, and maybe Pareto is not so clear regarding this point himself, is if people have different preferences, how would you understand that this is costly and this is not costly? This is a canonical problem of interpersonal comparison of utility. And the point I would contend now is that sometimes people have the same sense of costs and benefits, and sometimes they do not. So I think we should consider the two options. That is, sometimes people have a shared conception of what is a cost and what is a benefit, and sometimes they do not. And so my impression is that economic analysis is not always very clear regarding this. But we should introduce the notion of costs and benefits when they are clear and when people agree on a common definition of what they are. Regarding psychological reductionism, which is a complex issue, as it has been recalled this morning, Max Weber repeatedly says that there is a human psychology and we should take into account human psychology. But so he does not reject human psychology. But he says that there are many social norms, historical social norms, that cannot derive from an historical human psychology. The example he gives, which is not a small one, is capitalism. Say, well, capitalism, you cannot derive it just from an idea of human psychology. You have to have a specific historical events that correspond to a set of social norms that will tend to prevail at a certain time. And in fact, the psychological literature very often introduce the importance of social norms and social institutions and social settings that do not belong to the psychological theory as such. I'll take here two examples. One from Pinker in his work on the historical trend of decreasing violence. And in doing so, he introduced the role of the state, the impact of the state, and so on, beyond general psychological motives that are constant during the whole evolution. That is, the psychological dimension does not change as such, but it is the historical circumstances and the institutional circumstances that change. This is to the importance of Joseph Henrich's interpretation of the role of social norms in behavior and the selection of social norms. Something I would like to I will not develop that. I have written a paper about that, but I will not develop here the idea at length. In evolutionary psychology, there is a theory for developing the idea that we, by nature, have a tendency to belong to groups. That is, this is something that has been selected on the basis of evolutionary constraints. This is something that the argument has been developed in, I think, in the 1970s, and now it's rather common within the domain of psychology. And I have difficulties with this argument. Something that is not, to my knowledge, explained in this evolutionary model is why people would, at the very beginning, refer to a group when it is not a kin group, because it's not kin groups. Why would people consider that they belong to one group instead of another? And why, for instance, they would not cooperate with the member of another group just because they belong to one group? And if there is no kin constraint for that, we have no clear explanation of that major factor. And in fact, we have to suppose something that the like the adoption of a cultural norm that precedes the definition of a group. So my impression is that in order to understand social phenomena on the basis of individual actions within the Coleman's boat and so on, we have to rely on three dimensions of behavior. One is linked to unconscious psychology, developing the idea of biases, of unconscious motive of the type, for instance, someone like Jonathan Haidt developed, who don't tend to reject all that, considering that it is not acceptable because usually there are reasons that are linked to the fact that people will adhere to something or other. But it is not impossible that although people have reason, there are causal factors who are responsible for the behavior that are relatively independent of the reasons they give. So I do not think that we can escape so easily that type of argument. However, rationality is a very important concept. I disagree with Carl Dieter when he says that finally, this notion of rationality is not useful and that we should get rid of it just because there are too many meanings that are attached to it. And so it's more kind of a burden than anything else. And he tries to develop a simpler attitude to. But I think that whenever you think of people pursuing goals and trying to achieve their goals, you have to have a sense of rationality in the sense of that people try to find the relevant means that will allow them to achieve these ends. And it is this notion of relevance that is so important in the idea of rationality that is linked to a notion of reasoning and that is linked to a notion of having reasons and good reason to do something, whatever are the exact norms that are linked to this normative dimension of the notion of rationality. But I think that you need it, in fact, in order to explain behavior. And then, in fact, commonly, and this is a case for Coleman, for instance, commonly, we refer to social norms in order to explain common behaviors, but then we have to try to understand why those social norms are set up in a certain circumstances and why they tend to prevail at a certain time. Regarding Boudon, my master, and he was my lord as well at a certain time, he has a theory of the appearance of new norms, but he has not really a theory, to my knowledge, why there were norms before opposed to the ones that finally are adopted. That is, for instance, he defends the idea that we are in an egalitarian world and that we have good reason to support equality, but he does not explain why there were societies that were deeply unequal. He doesn't really have a theory. Anyway, so I think that we have to combine the three types of approaches in order to find something consistent to interpret human and social behavior and to interpret given social phenomena. And so to finish, and this is the main point of my talk, but I will not develop, because I have written a lot about that, but I will not develop here because it will go beyond the general reflection on methodological individual. We have a psychological evolutionary explanation of the idea of group belonging. As I have said before, this evolutionary model that is now common knowledge among psychologists does not address exactly the reason why there are specific cultural closures and why they are successful in explaining why people tend to belong to a group, but not why this group and why this group is linked to specific given norms. In fact, groups are linked to specific local norms. You have two levels of social norms in social life. You have social norms that you find everywhere, like cooperation social norms, and then people do not cooperate and so on, but they refer to cooperation social norm. And then you have local cultural norms, like the fact that people speak a given language, or they have a specific corporate culture that is supposed to link them within a given group. And so, in fact, that the idea here is that in a situation of social dilemma, where it is hard to trust other people, just because you don't know whether people are going to act selfishly or not selfishly, if you can rely on social norms that are respected, and if cultural norms signal the belonging to a group that will tell you that I am ready to respect the norm, then you will have a very strong sense of belonging. And people will, for instance, wear the same type of dress as a way of signaling the way they belong to a given group. And this has been devised by, famously, Max Weber, by James Coleman, and others. And so I think we have a clear understanding of the way of social norms, particularly social norms that are responsible for the definition of groups, arise. And then we'll give birth to the idea that those groups are opposed, that they have different interests. And then people will adhere to those norms, to those groups. And in doing so, they will be supported by psychological dimensions, like a sense of loyalty, things like that. And at the same time, sometimes, by a rational identification to a group because they understand the mechanisms that are responsible for that. So I think we have to introduce in our thinking of methodological individualism this complex, those complex dimensions of behaviors, and in particular, as Jean-Michel summarized so clearly this morning, emotions and social norms. Thank you.